Session number 9772.
Colonel Owen, reel 4. You were saying decisions were taken both by Leckie.
Yes, if he was taking if decisions or there were conferences and so on, I mean, the Commissar was always there, and they appeared to be joint decisions.
You said that the local population tended to be more pro-Chetnik than pro-partisan. Could you actually see evidence of that?
I think this was probably. No, I would never have said that there was never outward evidence because they would have been frightened to display outward evidence of being against the partisans in the villages when one was in them. But on the other hand, they were obviously. Food was a big problem, and of course, the partisans appearing in their area and their village. No doubt, from their point of view, presented problems because, partisans wanted food.
What was the military caliber of the 16th Division? Were they
First class.
a formidable force?
First class, absolutely first class. Do anything fearless, well led, and some incredible women. One of the sort of toughest. So the battalion commanders they had was a young girl, tough as hell.
What was her name?
I can't remember. But the women, one street, and the women, there was a mixed women and men. They were all together. Women carried, expected to do exactly the same as the men. I remember my impressions were really that women were stronger than the men on the whole, though they were slight people very often. But as tough and resilient to hardship and everything else, the women were very, very tough. I'm not saying they were all sort of farm workers or anything like that, but they had a great resistance to keep going. And you'd see them carrying exactly the same loads of ammunition, guns, or anything else.
Was communism just a label for them, or was there more sign of it than just a label communist? Oh, you've talked about the commissars and their political lectures, but anything else?
I think they used to give the people sort of lectures, but a great deal of this was intermixed with teaching. I mean, teaching of the people went on. I can't remember what percentage of illiteracy there was said to have been in Yugoslavia before the war, but it was extraordinarily high. And while all this was going on, whenever they had a break of a day or so or 2 days, there would be people being taught, particularly the young children, the younger people, because we had young boys of, I can't have been more than about 11 or 12, doing their part, the sort of messengers and so on, and armed and everything else. But they were being taught to read and write. And this, of course, went down. It's a great thing for the people. I mean, the thought of being able to read or write, or being taught to read or write, was colossal. And the other thing was that the women were treated as equals, whereas, as far as I could make out in the countryside generally, in Yugoslavia, in the mountain villages and so on, I mean, women were very third grade, fourth grade citizens. I mean, they were the beasts of burden, really. So all this was a most enormous development, telling people that there was a different sort of life for them.
It sounds as though you had tremendous admiration for
Oh,
them.
enormous admiration for them myself. I mean, one could never come across people who were, to my mind, more proud and loyal to you. I mean, they really were loyal. And they were not grasping. We had, we were loaded up with gold and dollars, everything you can think of, money-wise. Well, I mean, I came out and went back again for a second time. But in the whole time I was in there, I changed one sovereign somehow, because whenever I wanted local currency, and I'd go to the commissar and say, look, I want some dinar notes. He'd say, okay, how many do you want? I'd say, well, okay, I'll give you, sovereign, whatever it is. We don't want your money. And the answer was always, we don't want your money. What we've got is yours, if you need it. We don't ask you why you need it or what you need it for. But we trust you that you need it for the general good. They would never accept any gold or dollars, or, as you may know, the resistance in Greece and so on, they were all paid, they were financed. But our people wouldn't dream of accepting money, anything like that. And their honesty was beyond belief, I thought. I had an occasion once when I was, this was a little bit later on, down in the Srem, and I passed through a village called Gurk, G-R-K, and it had been razed to the ground. And a chap came up to me and said he'd been, sort of raking around through some of the old houses that had been burnt and so on. And he said, I found this little bag, and in the bag were, I can't remember how many, 20 or 30 sovereigns. He said, I think this must have been left behind by one of your colleagues, this chap, Basil Davidson, who'd been there. He said, I found it. It must be yours. Well, I mean, 30 sovereigns, if it was 30, was a fortune beyond belief to any of those people.
Was this honesty and loyalty typical of Yugoslavs generally?
Of those I met in the partisans, absolutely. I had the highest regard for them. All respects.
But do you think these characteristics derive from their Yugoslav nationality or their communist principles or what?
No, I don't think. I think just as people, they are basically a very proud people. Well, this has been shown by what has happened since the war. Very independent people, indeed, who have their code. And if you're their friend, there's no sort of end to which they will stop to show it.
You said that you went out and came in again. Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes. Well, we sort of went forwards and backwards, I say, for a period. And then, in about July, we heard there was going to be an evacuation of wounded from further inland, near a place called Tuzla, I should think, that sort of area, between Tuzla and Zvornik, where there was another British mission there with Kostanaj, actually, with him. And they had found a strip where they reckoned they could land Dakotas and take off wounded, which, of course, their wounded was the most terrible problem to these people, having wounded and having to lug wounded round the place. One of the greatest problems they had. And I was still with these people, which included this Vojvodina staff, who were in the wrong place. They were supposed to be down in the Danube. And they couldn't get there. And they said, when we heard there was going to be this evacuation, and they heard, obviously, before we did, they came and said to me, look here, would you get us out back to Italy? And if you do, you come with us. Yeah. We will then all drop into the Vojvodina, up near the Danube. And so I can't remember whether I referred this back to the base or not. I suppose I probably did. But anyhow, it seemed to me to be a good idea, because they were getting nowhere insofar as their operational role was concerned. And so we arranged. Oh yes, I obviously got it cleared by base. And they had these, it was about seven of them. Six, seven of them. And they all said, well, they would be all willing to parachute. If I could get them out, they'd be willing to parachute in, back in. And so we arranged this, and we went back. I think they managed to get eight Dakotas in, evacuating wounded. And we got out, went back with the Vojvodina staff, and with this chap Ted Howe, because he wasn't getting to Hungary either, he wasn't getting anywhere, and he was going back with the object of dropping in somewhere else further in. So we got out in the middle of the night and back to Italy, where somewhat to my dismay, having just got them back after the second day or so, and I said to them, now, okay, we've got to get fixed up for going back in, where are we going, etc., and what arrangements, because there were no British down in the area they wanted to go. The old fellow who was in charge, his name was Slobodan, Colonel Slobodan. I mean, Slobodan is a nickname. I mean, it means freedom. He said, look, I can't jump. I'm too old. And one or two of the others said they didn't feel like jumping either. And so this caused somewhat of a problem. I wasn't very popular because I had promised that, that come what may, they would they'd parachute in. And so they said to me, well, okay, you've got them out, boy. You jolly well get them back. You've got to somehow get them back in. You better go in somehow and find a place where you can land them. So we found an area where they, through the partisan net channel of wireless communications, we knew that they had some people down there. This was in the SREM. That is sort of getting on towards the Danube, right down beyond the other side of the Sava. And so I set off, got an aircraft, got a flight arranged, and with my old operator, Wardle, we set off. We actually had quite an amusing time over there because we hadn't any proper signals or any proper reception to drop to, except that we knew that there were supposed to be some partisans in the general area, but we had no direct communication with them. Anyhow, just as we were about to take off from Brindisi, with Brindisi Airport, we found that our crew were Poles. The air crew were entirely Poles. They didn't speak a word of English. And when my operator, Wardle, got into the airplane, he came there, suddenly came shouting out to me, said, my God, there's no wireless set here. I said, that's impossible, there must be a wireless set. No, he said, there isn't a wireless set. I know, because it's not a package here that could be a wireless set. So I said to, as I say, everyone used to have conducting officers who took you to the aeroplane, who were supposed to see it, everything was there, etc., etc. And everything was in order. Because you were never allowed to have any direct contact with the people loading or anything else. You said what you wanted and it appeared, that was the way things were done. Anyhow, I asked the conducting officer, I said, look, there's no wireless set. But he said, there must be a wireless set. Of course there's a wireless set. And I said, there isn't. I'm convinced that, my operator would know. So anyhow, meanwhile, the old Poles were the engine was going, and the engines were going, and the Poles were looking at the watch to come on. So anyhow, I said to the conductor officer, "Well," he said, "there must be another plane going with you or something. Must be another plane." Well, I said, "If there isn't another plane, and we're dumped down, thank you very much indeed. It's very kind of you. All we can do is to stay where we are, wherever we find ourselves, until you send us a wireless set." Not much use that wireless set. And off we went. Actually, I then wrote a little note in the plane, which I gave to the pilot. And they did drop us. And there was only one plane, and there was no wireless set. But it showed the organisation wasn't always terribly good. But we managed to find the partisans in the area, or they found us. And we waited where we were. I'd arranged to flash a signal if I, any time I heard an aircraft at night anywhere low. And I can't remember, after a week or 10 days or so, a plane came over and dropped us a wireless set and some stuff.
So it was just an organisational blunder.
Yeah. And then I arranged a landing strip for Dakota. Some extraordinary reason, because I'd been in air ops in Cairo, the RAF took it. I was sort of RAF trained, and because normally they wouldn't, they sent in their own people to arrange landing strips. They didn't really trust us. But however, through my air op connection, they never questioned my strips. I knew what the basic requirements were. And as soon as I got, found a suitable strip, that was that, and arranged and got a Dakota in with these chaps on board. I think one of the great things that did impress me was the extraordinary, what I'd call courage and ability, of the pilots who used to come in, because they never reconnoitred these fields. They came in at night, didn't circle, but used to come absolutely straight down onto the ground, just putting on their landing lights when they were about 20 feet off the ground, and then absolutely then straight down. And when you reckon they were landing to sort of uninformed people like myself, it really was quite incredible. And actually, at this particular landing strip, which I got this Vojvodina staff down to, which we used several times after that particular day, the Germans obviously knew where we were. The thing was, they couldn't get to us quickly enough. But what they could do was, they had we were fairly close to the main railway line, which went from Belgrade up to Zagreb, and they had a train on which there was sort of a small field gun mounted on this train, and they would see the sort of the flare path as the plane came down somewhere. And they used to shell this particular landing strip. And fortunately, we never had a plane actually hit. They couldn't see exactly, of course, where they were, because immediately they were down, they put their lights out. But my great fear was that a plane would get hit, or something might happen to it, because I knew that if anything ever once went wrong with one of one's operations, that would be the last time the RAF would ever come again. Sort of.
Whilst you were there operating in Yugoslavia, did the military collapse or quick withdrawal of the Germans occur?
No, when we were down in this particular area, which was the SREM, it was there are what they call the Friskagora, which are the mountains just along the fairly small mountains along the west bank of the Danube coming down there. This was the area in which we operated down there with this Vojvodina staff. This was their area in which they controlled. And we kept fairly well to that sort of area, except once we were chased. And I reckon we got jolly nearly up to Zagreb once on the run and back again. And on the other way, we went down to not very far from Belgrade. We actually landed planes within sight of Belgrade at one stage. But we sort of carried out general operations then. There was no collapse of the Germans at that time until the Russians, of course, came up through Romania and Bulgaria, and they came suddenly sweeping up. And it was a very tragic time, because one of the few things that we were able to do for the partisans at that stage was to, in fact, get rid of wounded. Because so long as we could get planes in, we could get their wounded out. And they were in a terrible state, and they had so many of them there. But when the Russian advance got nearer, there was an attitude. In fact, they stopped us. The Yugoslavs stopped us evacuating their wounded. And the only reason we could really gather was that they wanted to be able to demonstrate to the Russians when they arrived, look at what we've suffered, in a way, on one hand, and on the other hand, they had the idea that the Russian army, when it did arrive, would have all the sort of facilities that one would have thought of a sort of a Western army. But of course, when the Russians did arrive, it was quite a different matter. They arrived on foot and with horse-drawn guns and transport, and they were living on the land, of course. So it was quite a different Russian army to which actually overran us in due course than the sort of thing they'd been expecting.
Where did you first meet contact with the Russians?
I was in the Friskagora at the time, that sort of area, somewhere there. They arrived, and it was quite extraordinary, because they treated us with no hostility or sort of suspicion. They took us in tow. As far as we were concerned, they gave us they didn't get in our way in so far as where we went or watching what they were doing or anything else. But on the other hand, they treated the partisans like dirt. As the Russians got near, the partisan officers, wherever they could, had sort of got sort of uniforms, jackets made or something, and put on some golden stripes or something for rank. And they wouldn't allow them to go anywhere near anything. We were treated with the greatest of sort of propriety and so on. And I always think that, I mean, it was such a shock to the partisans, who thought here were the welcome they were giving to the brother Slavs and the great Russian army and so on, to be really treated like dirt by them. And I always thought that must have had something to do with the development of relations between Yugoslavia and Russia after the war.
You would have thought that there would have been a fellow communist feeling as well.
You would have thought so. Well, of course they did. The Yugoslavs thought this would, their brothers in arms coming. Not a bit of it. But they treated us well. We had a certain amount to do with them. Actually, we had we had landed one Russian aircraft. It was an American aircraft. It was a Dakota, piloted by a Russian pilot from somewhere. I can't remember where it came from, but we got down in our area. But things sort of gradually folded up. Insofar as our work in that area was concerned, it was the same old business of supplying arms, etc., and the same general bit of passing back information. And we got a certain number of, we evacuated a certain number of American pilots had been shot down and had come down in that area, and there was a sort of a chain by which you could get them back out of the country in due course. It was a quite different life to to life in Bosnia, because there it was very tough and very hard and mountainous and so on. And of course down there, down near the Danube, it was very lush. It was the summer then, and masses of food and fruit, and it was really quite a change. I mean, there were proper houses there which one had never sort of seen before.
Had the attitude of the local population in the Vojvodina been different from that in Bosnia towards the partisans?
I can't really quite judge that, really. I think they were I think yes, there was no doubt. I mean, the Germans had devastated a whole lot of these villages and little towns, and of course in that area, easier for them to get at and so on. And where they had evidence, or thought they had evidence of a collaboration with the partisans, of course they had no hesitation in just destroying the whole place.
Had there been any Hungarian army presence in the area?
Not that I know of. I didn't come across it.
Did you go into Novi Sad?
Yes. Actually went to Novi Sad, where the Russians had set up their headquarters. And after a few days, we went to Novi Sad.
What was the situation there?
They found us a very nice house. And there were actually, I was joined down in the Vojvodina by an OSS group. I can't remember whether it was one officer and two.